And my proposal says, let's get a little accountability into the system. And let's get these corporations to charter federally, the ones that have more than $1 billion of sales every year. And let's have a couple of features. First one, let's put some employees on the board. Let the employees elect some people. So you've got multiple representation on the board itself. Second one, let's change the compensation structure for the CEOs to say that the CEOs will not be permitted to juice the price. And then once they juice the price, make a quick sale, make a bazillion dollars, and keep emphasizing the incentives. That's what we've got now for short-termism. Want to get rid of it.
Is Elizabeth Warren's bold new proposal, as she laid out last week, a, quote, plan to destroy capitalism in order to save it? As Reason's Scott Shackford proclaimed, is it merely a modest reform in the corporate governance structure of the super rich, as the explainers over at Vox might say? Or, as The Economist magazine would always say, does the truth lie somewhere in between? Good Monday, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I'm Matt Welch, joined in discussion of these and other news-related events with my colleagues, Catherine Mega Ward, Nick Gillespie, and Peter Suderman. Hi, gang.
Hi.
Hi. Hi,
hello.
Matt.
Really like enthusiasm on Monday. Suderman, I want to start with you on this. Put on your wonky green visor thing. What is this thing, as such as we know, that Elizabeth Warren is talking about it? And is it a good idea or is it a great idea?
So it's basically a plan to change corporate governance in ways that sound good and populist on a on the campaign trail as Elizabeth Warren gears up for her inevitable run in 2020. And I think that the political angle here really shouldn't be overlooked. But let's take a look at the plan itself. It's the Accountable Capitalism Act is what it's called, and it would require that corporations earning more than $1 billion in revenue each year need a federal charter. Now, that's a big deal, is because right now they have to get – they only still have to get a charter from the government, but it would move – but it's the state government right now, and it would move that charter to the federal government. And then the charter would obligate these companies to consider all stakeholders rather than just shareholders. So that kind of means – everybody who is in the orbit of the corporation rather than just people who own it. It would also require those corporations to permit employees to elect 40% of the company's board of directors. Supermajority of 75% of directors and shareholders would have to approve political donations. So what Warren is really trying to do here is increase worker power within corporations and to give workers in particular more power over political donations from those large corporations, and at the same time to move the nexus of political control for those large corporations, again, with revenue over $1 billion a year, from state governments to federal government.
Catherine, part of the critique that we just heard from Elizabeth Warren is something you hear a lot. And actually, I think we heard the other week from Donald Trump when he was saying that we should have, instead of quarterly SEC reports, maybe every 6 months. But it's this critique that investors, Wall Street, the CEOs who respond to them are guilty of short-term thinking. And all I can think about when I hear that critique, which I've heard for decades now, is, okay, so explain Amazon.com stock over periods of time. Explain any company that has had a great share price when it didn't even have much in the way of profits for year after year. Is there something fundamentally flawed about that critique in general?
So I think that I would take a little bit of a different angle and say they are guilty of short-term thinking because they are human beings. Human beings are not great at long-term thinking generally. And the Warren plan is designed to incentivize people to do this thing they're not naturally good at, which is long-term thinking. The trouble is that this plan itself, and the reason it's been debuted in this way right now, is a classic example of politician short-term thinking, right? This plan exists at this moment in this form because Elizabeth Warren wants to win an election in a couple of years, not because this is actually the right way to restructure our markets. And it's true that CEOs also sometimes think in quarterly or annual horizons when they should probably be thinking in longer term. But you know what? No one is better at that. No one is going to do a better job at that. And the kind of like technocratic populism that Elizabeth Warren is embodying here, or at least like technocratic and worker oriented, since I don't think it's the popular interest overall. This is just like a Jacobin wet dream, as far as I can tell, and therefore my nightmare.
Thank you for that mental image.
Sorry. Yeah, sorry. Happy Monday, everyone.
Hurt. Yeah, not anymore. Matt, first off, I want to disagree with the idea that corporations, particularly corporations that have $1 billion in revenue, I'm looking at a 2013 article. There were about 1,900 companies in the U.S., that did that. It's probably up a bit since then. But I guarantee you that no company that's pulling in $1 billion a year is guilty of short-term thinking. And I know, a couple of weeks ago, I talked to John Mackey of Whole Foods, who's got his whole conscious capitalism thing, which is a lot of what Elizabeth Warren is talking about. They're doing it voluntarily, but it's, the amount of planning that goes into, like, if you're building a new store, the amount of planning and the long time horizon on that to get your money back, it's massively long. And, like, I think part of the problem with people like Warren is that they don't understand anything about business. This is a person who, when she was going to be the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, declared that no mortgage contract, no credit card, no loan thing could be longer than 2 pages. And it's just like, you're fucking stupid if you think that the world is that simple that you can just, like, say, OK, no, this is the way it's going to be. Businesses are killing themselves trying to figure out a way to stay in business from month to month, from year to year. And in doing that, sometimes they make a lot of mistakes because the markets are unpredictable and people don't know what they want from week to week or month to month. But businesses are constantly doing long-term planning. And there's also this fixation on CEO pay as somehow, like, if we can just knock it off at the top, everything will be better for workers. That just isn't the case. And there's tons of companies where the CEO makes a bazillion dollars, to use her technical term, and the workers do really well. And then there's, companies where the CEO takes a dollar in pay and then the company sucks to work for. This is all just bullshit on stilts. And I think it needs to be called out because it's from somebody who does not work in the private sector, doesn't understand how hard it is to fucking keep going.
So I actually do think, though, that, I mean, first of all, I just want to clarify, I think, of course, companies do long-term planning. The question here is whether they should be shifting toward more long-term thinking rather than more short-term. But more specifically, I actually think Elizabeth Warren, I mean, she doesn't work in the private sector, but I think she understands what she's talking about here. I think it's a mistake to critique her plan as a lack of understanding of how companies function. She thinks she knows better. Like, she knows what they're doing. She just thinks she knows better.
Well, you
and
know
that's
what?
A different then thing.
She can start at home. And the last time I checked, the U.S. government has a short-term revenue problem as well as a really long-term revenue problem. Why doesn't she do something to, like, actually fix entitlement spending?
Why don't you make her president?
And I realize that's like a version of whataboutism. But there, one of the things that Trump has opened up as a populist, and obviously Sanders and Warren are all in this kind of large boat, is still the idea that business is somehow evil and rotten and needs to be controlled. And you either want to pump up your friends in business, which Trump likes to do in various ways, or you want to tear them down. But one of the shifts that I think we need to take into account is the idea that populists, whether they're right wing or left wing, view business as a problem to be managed or a kind of special interest to be coddled and kind of protected. And we need to get away from that because it's over, to even be talking about corporations, as if they're U.S. entities, as if they're easy to regulate. In the end, what we need to be doing is freeing up markets in order to be more innovative and more creative. We need more new, weird kind of corporations in order to deal with changing economic reality and this kind of stuff. This is just, this is like out of the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And it's already been tried and it fails all the time.
The one thing that she said in her lead up here, she bought hook, line, and sinker this kind of sense of nostalgianomics, to use, I think, a Brink Lindsey phrase from back in the day, the 70s were really great. She posits that back in the day, CEOs and workers and everyone, they understood that we did it for the good of the economy. And this is, everyone understood it was a tri-directional win and the stakeholders and blah, blah, blah. And somehow it all began to change right around 1981. I think this grossly kind of removes from the collective memory just how much the Elizabeth Warrens of that day were huge critics of the same kind of CEO structure, the business climate, the three companies that ruled the world type of company man world back then. And they in the name of putting it all on Ronald Reagan, have a kind
well, it's
of
also
a
the customer shift. The customer drops out of this because it's, you know, so, you know, does the customer get in on the stakeholder? How many seats on the board do they get? Back in the day when it was General Motors, you know, which had the government really restricting imports, or the big three automakers, you know, so they were protected from competition. They were happy to deal with the United Auto Workers and give them whatever they wanted because they assumed that they could pass on forever increases in wages and things like that onto customers who had nowhere else to go. That system fell apart and it's never coming back. And the alternative to it is not more regulation. It is actually less regulation and allowing corporations to come up with different governance structures. And you know, one of the things I guess Peter was mentioning, you know, the shift of kind of chartering of corporations and of, you know, the rules that they govern from a state-based system to a federal one is pretty you know, disturbing. And everything in our lives is going towards dispersion and decentralization of power. The idea that that would be the one thing where we'd be like, oh yeah, now the federal government really, really should be laying out all of the rules for all the corporations and all the different states. And it'll be interesting to see how, like, you know, people from states like Delaware or the Dakotas, who may or may not be populist of their own, but they're not going to give up the, you know, the comparative advantages that they have in having different corporate structures than, you know, in New York or in New Jersey.
Or Nevada. Peter, is this the future Democratic socialists want? Is this another sign that we're heading in this DSA direction? Or in fact, are we heading in the DSA direction? But place this in that kind of question and narrative.
Well, you know, Elizabeth Warren claims that she is a big fan of markets and competition and how they work. They just need rules. And I actually think that this is Elizabeth Warren attempting to sort of carve out a niche in a competitive Democratic market for herself. So if you look at the sort of Democratic social, the hardline Democratic socialist argument, the stuff that is being proposed by folks like Cortez, it's basically a lot of big spending programs. It's Medicare for all. It's free free public tuition, that sort of thing. That argument right now is getting a lot of pushback just because the spending is so high that even Democratic voters, when faced with this sort of thing, are balking in some cases. And so I think this is Elizabeth Warren preparing for 2020, not by saying, I don't want to do Medicare for all. She's going to say, oh, I think it's an interesting idea. We should definitely be looking at that, healthcare for all Americans. She will back that. But by saying she doesn't want to have the spending argument, instead, she wants to have a corporate regulation argument. And that's where she is going to make her move.
Catherine, do you see like a trend line, Democrat or Republican, and Republican, I should say, in attempting to enact social policies on the backs of businesses in that way? Yeah, we're not going to nationalize the economy. Yeah, we're not going to necessarily spend all the money, although, of course, they're spending all the money. But, you know, it might be kind of over for gigantic new initiatives, given the political realities on the ground. But everywhere you look, it seems you see state, local governments and people dreamcasting on the federal level of, we could only get this if we just tell businesses that they need to you know, have this number of workers on their boards, or have these rules, you know, or have a $15 minimum wage. Is this the backdoor of policy, and how do we like fight against that?
Yeah, and everybody does it, right? This is also how we are doing a major component of our immigration enforcement. We're basically saying to businesses, we will shut down your business if you employ an illegal immigrant and get caught and then employ another one 6 months after that, which is only a slight exaggeration of the state.
Well, and if they have perfectly good fake documents. So, like, you're responsible. And even, I mean, because they all have documents, but yeah, you have to be a counterfeit expert as well as like the ultimate enforcer of immigration law.
Right. And in Arizona, for instance, when they tried using, a version of these e-verify type databases, there were even businesses, which Shikadalmi has reported on, where they verified their employees against this database, but the database was flawed. And then the feds came in and punished them for employing those people. So it happens there, I think, on the Republican side, as well as in the obvious ways of on the Democratic side. There's just this idea that corporate profits are the government's slush fund. Like, there's all this money. It's profits. We could definitely do better things with that money than the companies are. Let's give it away. Here. Minimum wage and regulations and, shareholders and stakeholders get to decide.
Tariffs,
right. I mean, this is the justification for tariffs is like, but there are profits as if that
Warren's
money is free
in
money.
In the Wall Street Journal actually talked about shareholders extracting $7 trillion in profits since 1985 that might otherwise have been reinvested in the workers who helped produce them. It is directly and explicitly an argument that those profits should have been used better and that the government will now come in and say how to use them better.
And what's more, there's, that idea reflects people's, like, the average Joe's common sense understanding of profits. Like, that's the problem. That's why this is so convincing, is because the case for leaving profits in the hands of corporate governance entities is a two-step, at least, right? The idea that the average Joe has about profits is that it's this sort of magical money that was created out of nothing and can be used for whatever. And that's that it's understandable that people who aren't involved in particularly in large corporations think that way. It's less understandable when people who understand what profits do and are for want to take them and reallocate them anyway.
The flip side of that, though, of the Democrats trying to cost more social programs onto corporations, and I think Catherine's right, the way that the Republicans are happy to do that when it comes to law enforcement concerns, particularly about immigration. You now have and this is kind of a populist type thing, too, on the Republican side, like with the Paid Family Leave Act that Marco Rubio and a bunch of other people are pushing, where they're saying, oh, we're going to take that off the back of businesses because we understand how the economy works. So we're going to let people who want to have paid family leave, like, we're not going to force the company to pay. We're going to let taxpayers in the year 2525, if man is still alive, pay for it because people can suck the money out ahead of time. And this is, again, this is like we're, Peter wrote a piece in the New York Times a while ago, which is totally right. The Republicans, by giving up even pretending to care about fiscal sanity and fiscal responsibility, both sides now, Republicans and Democrats, can just start laying out programs that they want to spend a lot of money on. And nobody is ever going to be like, OK, where's the check? Where's the bill? Because, that's where all of these programs go to die, because people realize when you have to fucking pay for this shit, it's not worth it. If it's free, maybe. But like if it's even 20 cents on the dollar, like, fuck it.
There's also an element in her wind up interviewing with Jim Cramer, of all people, Mad Dog, talking about this, in which Elizabeth Warren and a lot of her supporters will say, well, it's only about 10% of Americans who really have a significant amount of money invested in the stock market. So it's really not going to affect all that many people. That this comes out of the same mouths of people who are otherwise super happy to bitch about how mom and pop companies can't get credit for their businesses. It's like, do you understand what the stock market is? Do you know what they're doing?
Do you even stock market, bro?
Do you stock market even just a little bit, bro? It's this the weird, it's like a reverse thing. I mean, remember the George W. Bush?
Matt, yes. This is just why we need the American Small Business Investment Fund and why it needs to be managed out of a new regulatory agency who also put its stamp of approval on those businesses and what they can and can't do. I think really you're overthinking this. It's so straightforward.
Your like Xanax voice there is making me scared and depressed.
Yeah. It's very because anxious. At some point, he's just going to surrender.
So
it's going
how
to be
do you
the
how do you reset
surrender.
This conversation though? And there are elements that you know that are on the right and the left. Both you know, it's obviously more the left, I think, or the Democratic Party. But I mean, because this is like it's all premised on the idea that the government is going to be the main kind of structural agent in the economy, but then also fairness. That it's going to be able to spread everything around. And is it that we have to have a different conversation where we're talking about like the government should guarantee minimal basic outcomes for people. So, you know, you get, if you're poor, you can get some health care, if you can get education, et cetera. But I mean, like, because this is, you know, once you kick free of any pretense of fiscal responsibility or rectitude, then the sky's the limit. And you know, the government, there's an infinite number of ways that, you know, people within the government can say, this program will help some people, so let's do it. I mean, how do we change that conversation? Because you cannot stop it. It's just all of the, you know, it's just going to be more and more incoming proposals of, well, this tweak won't cost anything because it'll come out of rich people or it'll come out of foreigners. It'll come out of illegal immigrants. I mean, we really need like a different conversation, don't we?
I think you just should stop enacting social policies by regulating businesses. If you want to do social policy as a government, do a social policy, raise the revenue for it, spit it out, do what you need to do, do what you want to do, put a price tag on it, make people understand what it costs. But don't do that on the backs of businesses by limiting their amount of freedom to do what they want to do. It's just not going to work. It's a hidden tax on things, on consumers elsewhere. And it's not honest. You know, if you want you fill in the blank outcomes, either you pay for them and provide them in some ways, but don't put that on the backs of businesses, or else you're going to get the equivalent of, you know, what you have in the New York City housing market, for example, or anywhere else in places that have housing shortages and high prices. They put these huge burdens on developers. If you're going to do X, then you're going to need to develop all of this low income housing and these types of things. And what happens as a direct result? No one builds anything. No one wants to. Or you spend all your money lobbying to get waivers to stuff. And it really distorts the entire, not just economic field and real estate field, but political field as well. That's what everything becomes about. And you just build this entire web and maze. Go back to the first principles of it. Don't enact social policies on the backs of businesses. Period. And then kind of go from there is where
Republicans have their own version of this, of course, which is that they like to run their social and spending programs through the tax code and do everything as a tax credit. And you can even look this summer in a very small example, which is that Republicans in Congress were just a month ago or so considering a bill that would basically that would create a tax carve out for businesses to subsidize basically for gym memberships. And it was really just a subsidy for people who already have gym memberships. It's going to cost a couple of billion dollars a year, I believe, or perhaps over a decade, I forget. But anyway, it was like a couple of billion dollar price tag on this thing. And this is a pretty conventional way of Republican spending, right? They do it through the tax code instead of providing direct spending for something. They will just provide a tax break. And of course, then there's a deficit effect. And that's how we basically get the situation we have right now in which there's a spending party and a tax cuts party. And there's no let's actually pay for things party.
Let's use that as a an opportunity to talk about something really uplifting, which
that
is
kind of the saddest party, right? The let's be responsible and you know, just have soft drinks and pay for them. We'll pay for each cup of soda as we drink it, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, at that party, you definitely straws. Get like you. That's the I brought my iPod rather than hiring a DJ party. It's not as good.
So last week, the Pennsylvania Attorney General released a grand jury report, just an absolutely sickening grand jury report documenting 7 decades worth of sexual abuse of something like 1,000 kids. More than 300 priests were implicated. several high-ranking existing people in the Catholic Church remain implicated. This morning, I think, Pope Francis issued a statement. We showed no care for the little ones. We abandoned them. I don't think he has any concrete recommendations about who and how many people are going to get fired or defenestrated, whatever they do these days with this. Something about all of this latest scandal feels somehow different to me. Maybe it's just because it's the latest scandal. It feels like we've been going through this since 2000 or so when these kind of happen. It's shocking that. And this is, again, this is just in the state of Pennsylvania. Something like three quarters of the state of Pennsylvania is the only thing under discussion here. I've seen a lot of conservatives and Catholics as disgusted as human beings as I recall anyone seeing in ways that I don't recall in the same kind of thing happening in 2000 and 2002. Nick, you're the ex-Catholic among us here who has a great respect for America's religious traditions here. No, I mean, that's totally true.
I was I think, looking at my scapulas the other day, and you can look that up. So, yeah.
Thank you for references.
Why, but that, can I ask first, Matt, you have cryptically mentioned a couple of times that you are now attending a Catholic church.
Sure. Yeah.
What, I mean, are you converting or?
No. No, my wife's Catholic. She's French. My two daughters
Wait, your wife is French?
Yeah, I know. I don't bring that up enough.
All right. I just, bingo. I have bingo now.
Actually, the sex abuse scandal is part of the reason why I attend, and I will explain very briefly because that sounds weird.
But
the first time,
that sounds really weird.
We walked through the doors of this place. It's the oldest Italian church in Brooklyn. Nick, and the priest in his opening, whatever you call it, homilies. That's what those things are. He spent a lot of time.
It's a tight five, Matt.
Railing against the Catholic sex abuse scandals and underlying that the church is not the Pope, the church is not the bishops, it's not the clergy, it's not even the priest. The church is everyone here in this room. That's the definition of church, and you shouldn't. None of these people are fallible, and we've seen through their actions.
The church is Soylent Green.
That they can be terrible. And by the way, we're having a viewing of Spotlight later on. So this kind of spoke to me as, okay, he's not going to be in cahoots with all this kind of bad stuff. So I have my my own personal reasons for things like that. But Nick, I look at this kind of stuff and you being an experienced Catholic, is it Catholicism? Is it the way that the church is structured that it keeps coming back to this church in this country doing these things? Is it just they have a bigger target on their back? Is there something inherent to the organization of this stuff that I don't quite understand?
Well, I don't think in terms of, and to the extent that I've looked into any of this, the amount of sexual abuse by clergy against, you know, parishioners or congregants, it does not seem to be higher as a percentage of, you know, if you look into Jewish organizations or Muslim or Protestant, you know, you're going to find a certain amount. It is more publicized, and it's partly because Catholics are the single largest religious group in the country. You know, if you add up all the Protestants, they far outnumber. But and in Pennsylvania, something like 25% of the population is Roman Catholic. So there's a lot of people out there, and the church. It's not to the church's credit because this was all forced on them, but the transparency that has come out because of the abuse stuff that really started coming out in the early 2000s, you know, they keep coming back because there's a lot of material to go through. And, you know, the Pennsylvania grand jury, which covered, I think, six of the eight dioceses in Pennsylvania, because the two other ones had already done this. But, you know, it goes back like 70 years. And one of the things that a lot of kind of semi-defenders or apologists will say, well, like most of this stuff happened years ago. I mean, some of the examples go back to the 30s and whatnot. And we've cleaned up our act. There may be some truth to that because everything is more transparent now. And in the same way that you know, even though it seems like cops are more brutal than they used to be, they're probably more professionalized and less abuse of civil liberties than they used to be, but they're more likely to get caught. I think there's something to that in the way that we're talking about the church abuse scandals. The single biggest payout was in Covington, Kentucky, in around like 2005. And a lot of that went back decades and decades, and it's just harder to get away with this stuff now. But I think your priest is, you know, the way he's talking about stuff is pretty interesting, because one of the problems with the Catholic Church is that the parishioners don't count as much as the priests. The priests are what the church is built around. I mean, they are, to the extent that the Pope is the vicar of Christ on earth, you know, which he is. The priests are kind of like the mini popes, and they wield a huge amount of institutional power, not to fuck kids or something like that, but like they are able to transform bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. The organization revolves around them. So, and the church has been really slow to punish and to really do the kind of cleansing and purification of its ranks. And then what you're going to find, because, you know, in the cardinal of D.C., recently had to retire, he was working for the Vatican at this point, but Theodore McCarrick was pushed out after an abuse allegation from years ago came out. Like, it is really hard to do this, and the church is a slow moving kind of glacial thing. They're never really going to deal with this. It's just going to keep coming out and coming out and coming out, and people will be pissed. And I think American Catholics, more than others, because this happens all over the world, American Catholics come from an individualist background, and like they get really pissed, and you see the hollowing out of the church's authority, I think, among Catholics. You see declining rates of church participation and other things, because as with many other major institutions, people have lost trust and confidence in the ability of this thing to do what it says it's supposed to do.
Nick, Peter, you're going
to
say?
No, just as to your point, Nick, that the church really revolves around the priests and doesn't include the parishioners as much. Are you basically saying that they need a new corporate governance structure that does
probably
a better
job? They need some stakeholders.
Considering all the stakeholders? Because
I think they should have 40%
Nick is the Elizabeth Warren of the Catholic Church. Oh,
no,
my
but, you know,
God.
And the Catholic Church has been at this for 2,000 years, you know, and it's kind of modern iteration really came out of the 19th century, a reaction to modernity with the First Vatican Council, where democracy and capitalism were denounced by the Pope and by the College of Cardinals because these were bad things that were going to lead to liberation of women and, you know, people being able to vote and have self-determination. It's fascinating. If you know, like most religious institutions today will make a claim that they go back, you know, to the ancient pharaohs of Egypt and all of that. But most of them, whether you're talking about Islam, Judaism, or most Protestant churches, as well as Catholic ones, really go back to the mid-19th century and how they reacted to or embraced modernity. But the Catholic Church has real problems. And, you know, the other thing about it is that Pope Francis in the U.S. is considered, especially among libertarians and conservatives, he's a communist when it comes to economics, which is, you know, basically true. He thinks capitalism is evil and rapacious and it hurts people. He's stupid about that. But theologically, he's really conservative. And he's not going to change anything.
I do think that there's at least one other parallel worth talking about briefly, which is like, did the Catholic Church do Me Too before it was cool? Right? Like, is what we're seeing now in the church like what we have to look forward to as the kind of Me Too movement or like the Me Too attitude rolls through other industries? Right? And obviously, it is far from a perfect parallel, and a better parallel might actually just be the way that unions interact with their host organizations, right? I mean, this is the kind of behavior that the church exhibited around its problematic priests is very, very reminiscent of the way that teachers' unions protect bad teachers and the way that police unions protect bad cops. You know, that pattern is clear, but I do think the rolling waves of lack of tolerance for behavior that was previously tolerated or even understood as normal because the victims spoke out and were believed is something that we might need to be careful about saying, like, oh, you know, shake our finger at the Catholic Church because that behavior is I think I agree that that behavior is not church specific. It's a human problem, and it happens in our other institutions too.
And by the way, speaking of which, Asia Argento, who was one of Harvey Weinstein's most vociferous detractors, there's a New York Times story out that she paid off an actor who she had sex with in California, a boy at age 17. The age of consent is 18. So Me Too is really getting, pretty kind of eating its own tail at this point.
Again, an unfortunate image. Knitting yeah, together both of your points, Nick and Catherine, I'm sort of wonder out loud in countries like France, where my wife is from, that have where the church is the dominant institution. I presume that we will see this happen later. I mean, already it's...
Oh, it already happened in Ireland. There's a huge amount of... any place where, a particular organization, whatever it is dominant in various ways. And it's interesting because France has its anti-clerical roots. So the Catholicism is kind of tempered in a way that it wasn't in Ireland until recently. And Ireland was a shit show. I mean, it was... abuse, sexual abuse, but also just physical abuse at orphanages that were run by fucking nuns. I mean, this is again, it's also throughout Africa and throughout Latin America where the Catholic Church is really big and in many cases played a signal role in pushing back against repressive governments, whether they were right wing or left wing at various points. So it's, but it's not cleaned its house. And I don't see any reason to think that it will. I think you're just going to keep seeing this. And the one thing the Catholic Church knows how to do is to survive,
Peter, you're from Florida, so you're obviously brought up Pentecostal. Is there a basic and simplistic kind of power analysis here of just power corrupts and bureaucracies excel in covering up their own kind of malfeasance in a way of like corporate governance to make the problem go away?
I was a United Methodist, the Southern conservative kind of United Methodist. Not a Pentecostal. And in fact, it was the Methodists and the Baptists who sort of fought for control over my town. So I think I actually want to tell a little story about my church that I grew up in, which
was a Florida story,
just a little
Peter.
Florida story. When I started going
Florida
there.
Florida priest.
I don't really know anything about Florida priests, but when I started going there, the average Sunday attendance was something like 1,000, relatively large but not gigantic. And then over time, by the time I sort of graduated from college, I started going there around the age of 10 or 12. And by the time I was in my early 20s and getting out of college, the church had expanded to something like 2,500 or 3,000. And now when I go back home, it's 4,000, maybe 5,000. There are all of these buildings. There's services that start Saturday night and then run basically like all day through Sunday, as well as satellite churches sort of across the area. They've bought up all of this land, built all of these buildings. They do things like, in addition to just sort of like the local in addition to doing things that they've always done, which is like helping people in need locally, they now have things like transportation services and pre-K, basically education. And if you look at really what the church, what my specific church has done in its area, it has become a competitor to government. It does transportation. It does education. It does basically welfare programs for the poor. It also has community centers, basketball courts, a gym, that sort of thing. And so I really think that people need to understand, need to think about churches and the way the church acts as a private non-state competitor to government. And that is what the Catholic Church, maybe more than any other religious institution, certainly Christian religious institution, for the last couple of thousand years has been. It has been a sort of collaborator with and competitor to governments for centuries now. And so they're not exactly the same, obviously. I think you can extend that analogy a little bit too far. The Catholic Church doesn't, for example, doesn't have the power to tax anyone, but they do, sort of expect a tithe, right? And so the problems that exist in government are often the problems that exist in large social institutions like churches, because in many ways they're seeking to do many of the same things, which is to organize people into a way of life, into a common culture, and then to provide for those people when they're in need, and in some cases when they're not, but to sort of provide for a kind of lifestyle and a common culture together. And so without sort of getting into the very specifics of this report and of all this, I really do think that it is useful to think of big churches and to think of big church institutions as non-state quasi-government entities.
That's one of the reasons they were attacked, you know, under both left-wing and right-wing governments. The Catholic Church was always, you know, or the church in general, but the Catholic Church in many places was a direct source of countervailing power to the state. Sometimes they you know, went with the state, and that's almost never good. But you know, in the United States, one of the things that happened, and this is also a big shift, in Catholics are probably declining. There's mixed results, or you know, mixed numbers, but Catholics were heavily you know, started coming over in big numbers in the late 19th and early 20th century as the country was urbanizing. By 1960, cities started emptying out in 1950, and the Catholic school system, which was huge, is much smaller than it used to be, and it is no longer, like a lot of those schools in urban areas just closed down, and that was part of the kind of cultural power and the staying power of the Catholic Church, and I think that's gone. And then when you add to it, and now there are charter schools and other competitors that are non-religious, we're a much more secular country in general. But when you look at the way that the Catholic Church refuses to really act decisively in, you know, in this kind of thing, it's like when Volkswagen doesn't respond, you know, to, you know, get, or, you know, has to respond to faking its diesel results, when the United Way is found out to be scamming a ton of shit, when the government, you know, is fucked up, like people lose faith and they evacuate it as much as possible.
So speaking of Opus Dei, last week, President Trump got rid of John Brennan's security clearance, former CIA director, who just this morning, I believe, the president called the worst CIA director in history. He got rid of his security clearance based on Brennan's criticism of Trump and potential involvement in the Russia investigation or commentary on it, which, to be clear, included Brennan accusing Trump of treason on Rachel Maddow's MSNBC program, I think based on his meeting with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. This is a statement that I think Brennan has kind of either walked back or he's not no longer supporting. At any rate, that removal of a security clearance led all three broadcast networks as the lead story, Trump stifling the free speech of John Brennan last week. And I think that even happened on the same day that 200-odd newspapers decided to all collude in writing editorials about how Donald Trump is the enemy of the free press. And then over the weekend, a murderer's row of former CIA directors, including Michael Hayden and David Petraeus and whatnot, all got together. And James Clapper, former DNI, got together and signed a letter of finger wagging at Donald Trump. So, Catherine, is this just reason to hate everybody in America?
Always my answer to that question will be yes. That was like it's not even a softball. That was like a beanbag question or something.
Yeah, it's a T-ball.
Yeah. T-ball seems scary to me, so I don't know. But
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So I think that actually, and this is a great example of why people like Donald Trump, right? His tweet from this morning where he says, "Everyone wants to keep their security clearance. It's worth great prestige and big dollars, even board seats. And that's why certain people are coming forward to protect Brennan." That's bad. Like, that's bullshit. And he just said that out loud, which presidents and people who have political power typically don't do. Like, the reason people want to retain security clearance when they leave office is because it is worth money. And that's you know, it creates a kind of weird class system in D.C. You know, people have job prospects after they leave office dictated by exactly the status of their security clearance. But it's a total, like, privileges and perks reserved to a tiny elite ruling class. That ruling class is highly connected with the press. That's why that story leads every broadcast. I do want to I will tell my own small story here about this very quickly, which is that the
you
school
went
year
to the Church of Security Clearance.
I grew up in DC, so I did go to the Church of Security Clearance, and the school year started today. DC public school started today, which means I once again have to go get tuberculosis tested and fingerprinted so that I can volunteer to go on field trips I don't want to go on anyway. But if you have top secret clearance, you can skip that step. DC public schools have a special provision for people.
Because you can't
if
get
you have,
tuberculosis, right?
If you have
a security clearance.
If you have federal security clearance verification
is inoculated?
Letter, you can skip being fingerprinted by the DC public schools.
So, so does it worry you that, like, I mean, don't you feel that's unfair that John Brennan now can't take your kids on a field trip?
I lay awake nights, Peter, for sure. You know, that's just a small example, though, of like these are the kind of dumb privileges that accrue to people with these clearances. And Trump is right to call it out and say the reason everyone is so fierce about protecting this is because it's worth a lot to the individuals who happen to be lucky enough to have it.
I was
but
thinking
Peter, isn't Trump
that
also
the,
wrong, damn it.
I was just going to say, on. I think that the newspaper protest, you know, where the press is showing it's independent, you know, by all writing in cahoots the same thing about Trump. I think it would have been much more effective if it had been the comics page that had been, you know, kind of coordinated. And like, wouldn't you have loved
like
to see
Nancy
like,
was like down
yeah,
with Trump?
Sluggo is obviously a Trump supporter, right? You know, but it's like Marmaduke and Heathcliff. Like, what would they have done to, you know, show dissatisfaction?
Or better yet, Farmaduke, which is a key Twitter follow for those of you out there. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I was recently looking at the International Herald Tribune, which now, if it's the New York Tribune, and it sucks, it used to be a great newspaper. They now have, I think, just 6 comics left, and all of them haven't been live comics for like decades. It's like Peanuts, Doonesbury.
The Lockhorns. Cats and Jammer Kids. I hope they...
I don't begin to understand it. Peter Suderman, will you not at long last weep for the destruction of mores by the president in willy-nilly, you know, punishing his political enemies, even if they deserve it in the face and the punishment doesn't matter much?
I am weeping for no one this morning, except possibly myself and our podcast listeners. I think Scott Shackford, who wrote about this for Reason.com, was basically right. On the one hand, Brennan doesn't really need or deserve a security clearance. Brennan's security clearance allows him to go on television and criticize Trump in getting towards unhinged terms. And I'll talk about that more in just a minute. And then to say, well, basically, because I have a security clearance and worked in the intelligence community, I know all this stuff that I can't really tell you. And so it gives Brennan a sort of the ability to say, well, there's all this stuff that you don't know that I do, which is kind of it's really dicey to do that, because if he actually knows information, he either shouldn't be sharing it, because the whole security clearance thing is about whether you're trustworthy to keep that information compartmentalized, or there's not really any information there, and so it's all bluster. And in fact, you mentioned the treasonous thing, and where he said that Brennan said that Trump's meeting with Putin was treasonous, and then he went back on Rachel Maddow and said, "Well, I really didn't mean treasonous when I said treasonous. I did say, this is a quote, I did say that it rises to and exceeds the level of high crimes and misdemeanors and nothing short of treasonous, because he had the opportunity to go there to be able to say to the world that this is something that happened. And that's why I said it was nothing short of treasonous. I didn't mean that he committed treason."
Sure.
That's Brennan is saying about Trump. And so, of course, you can see, Trump's case that Brennan is being erratic and that Brennan is acting in a way that is kind of unhinged, I think, is not wrong. On the other hand, Trump himself has basically said that this is entirely payback for Brennan being a political critic of Trump and for his role in the Mueller investigation. Trump told the Wall Street Journal, and let me see if I can pull up this quote here. Trump told the Wall Street Journal that it was, you know, I call it the rigged witch hunt. It is a sham, and these people lied, so I think it's something that had to be done. It had to be done because Brennan played a role in the Mueller investigation. And so Trump, I think the way to think about this is that Brennan doesn't deserve a security clearance, but Brennan probably doesn't deserve to be singled out for not deserving a security clearance, and that what Trump is doing here is political payback. And what we would really like to see, ideally, is a systemic reform of the security clearance system for people who are no longer in government. That's not what we got. Instead, we got Trump being Trump, which is to say Trump doing a thing that is somewhat justifiable narrowly, but not really not really thoughtful, not really coherent, and mostly about punishing his political enemies.
You know, something else, though, that is really disturbing about this, and it goes to the kind of media angle of all this. Like, you know, the deep state, and as a shorthand, let's define it as people in the American intelligence community. They've had a really shitty century, and they've been unmasked serially as liars. I mean, going all the way up to the president, obviously, when Obama was faced with the Edward Snowden revelations, and he was like, oh, you know, I welcome the opportunity to talk about all this shit that I was doing and keeping completely secret from you. We, you know, the media really needs to step up and stop kind of sucking up to people who, you know, because it's in the current moment, either for liberals and progressives to have like a bunch of people who are saying Trump is a tool of Russia, he's evil, you know, all of that kind of stuff, that's fucked up. But then you have on the right people who never want to question the seriousness of the U.S. intelligence community, whether we're talking about the FBI or the CIA or the NSA. And like, these are bad actors. These are people who are not honest and not open. I mean, they lie to Congress, even as they are illegally investigating Congress, as well as everybody else. Like this, you know, there needs to be a major reckoning here. And I agree with Peter that because Trump is a dick and he doesn't act out of principle, he acts out of, you know, like personal motivation, we're not going to get there. But we really need this. This is a conversation worth having of like, you know, these intelligence operations and even the positions that we're talking about are not, you know, they weren't here when the Mayflower landed. They're created and they're mostly, you know, of increasingly recent vintage, both after World War II, but even more recently after 9/11. We really need to have a serious media driven discussion about what the fuck is going on and why are we trusting and why are we relying on people who we know will lie to their they'll lie under oath. You know, much less to fucking Rachel Maddow.
Oftentimes in the same kind of high dudgeon that they're now inveighing, if that's a word, against Donald Trump. I just am going to point out that my next jug band is going to be called the Deep State Resistance Grifters. And you can look for our CD on cdbaby.com to throw it in the past. Let's shift, since we've got a hard out here in a few minutes, let's shift to our end of podcast, What Y'all Reading stuff. I'm going to go first in case anyone has any commentary associated with what I've been reading. And this says a lot about my cultural intake these days. The thing that struck me the most was a poll that I read from Emerson University, I think it is. It's the Emerson College. It's the first poll that incorporates Gary Johnson as a Senate candidate in New Mexico. He announced finally last week that he was going to do this against Martin Heinrich, the overwhelming favorite in New Mexico, a blue state. Heinrich, 39%. In second place, Gary Johnson, Libertarian, 21%. In a distant third, Mick Rich, and what a good name that is, Republican, 11%. That's pretty startling. I don't recall, with the exception of maybe one case in Alaska, which is a confusing case, I don't recall a Libertarian jumping out of the gate, getting anywhere near, two times on the third place candidate for the U.S. Senate. And I think that'll be increasingly interesting to watch. You already see a lot of Democrats freaking out about Gary Johnson's entrance into that campaign. Nick, what are you reading, kind sir?
I am. Well, can I ask you a question about, like, do you think, is Gary going to gain or lose steam as the as the election comes closer? Because he obviously was a popular two-term governor did well there. I mean, obviously did his best in the as an LP presidential candidate in New Mexico. But like, can he actually close that gap, or is he going to dribble down to, you know, 3%?
I have a hard time. He won't go down to 3%. He got 9% in New Mexico as a presidential candidate. And Mick Rich is completely unknown, never ran before. He's like a contractor out of Albuquerque. The big question there is, will Mick Rich drop out of the race? You already see, I think, in that poll, a majority or a plurality of Republicans back Gary Johnson and not Mick Rich, which is a pretty decent sign that maybe if you want to unseat the Democrat, that he ought to bug out. But Gary Johnson told me that he spoke to Rich and he's kind of pissed off about everything and wants to stay in until the end. So I have a hard time believing Johnson can win in a three-way race because New Mexico is an overwhelmingly Democratic state and he's going up against the incumbent. That said, Democrats haven't spent any time thinking about this race until last week or 2 weeks ago and are now scrambling the jets, and that could give a mover advantage to the new old weirdo running. So what are you reading, Nick?
I'm reading Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt's book that's coming out officially in a couple weeks. I'm going to be interviewing them. It's based on their Atlantic story from a year or two ago, The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. And the most interesting thing about this, it kind of describes millennials to a certain degree, and especially Gen Z, and the ways in which the world in which they grew up has changed in ways that we're kind of familiar with. Some of this is about snowflake culture, although they're not pejorative in that sense, but shifts in the way kids are raised. The most interesting stuff, which I'm not fully done with yet, is what do we do next? Because there's actually a lot of like growing, you know, and I say this as I'm a father of a millennial and a Gen Z boys, like, a lot, you know, they're growing up in a better world than I grew up in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And a lot of that is worth preserving. But there are kind of recurring generational issues about resiliency, about kind of being outward seekers rather than kind of drawing inwards and asking for an all-encompassing system to redress all of your grievances. It's a fascinating book.
Suderman, what are you reading?
I am watching the Netflix show Voltron: Legendary Defender, which is a reboot and rethinking of the classic Voltron cartoon that's been put together by some alums of some of the best animated series of the past 20 years, folks who have worked on The Legend of Korra and Justice League Unlimited. And it turns out to actually be it's geared at kids, but it's also the sort of show that I think adults, certainly those who sort of have an interest in comic books, cartoons, that sort of thing, science fiction, can really enjoy. It's much smarter and more mature about relationships and characters than a lot of kids' cartoons. And the action sequences, especially in the latest season, which just dropped on Netflix about a week ago and features the alien bad guys invading Earth in a something of a big reveal. The Galra have taken over Earth and sort of destroyed most of it as the Voltron crew return home after a long journey through space. And so if you're looking for a big epic science fiction television serial right now, I would actually I would probably place this at the top of the list. It's even if you are not somebody who's looking for a kids show and not trying to find something that that is just appropriate for kids.
Catherine, what are you Voltroning?
Right in the same category, unfortunately. So I took my daughter to her first comic book store this weekend.
Yes.
And at her request, we were walking down the street and she was like, hey, they got Wonder Woman in there. Let's go check it out. And it was the future liberals want for comic book nerdery, like a young gender queer woman of color greeted a small girl at the door of the comic shop and showed her to the section for comics that appeal to small girls. And it was like, wow, this is...
And there's a lot of comics like
amazing.
That now.
So I want to recommend DC Superhero Girls. There is a series of graphic novels that also go with a television show. My daughter chose the issue titled Summer Olympus, in which Wonder Woman goes to hang out with her dad, Zeus, on Olympus for the summer and hangs out with all the Greek Gods and Goddesses. It is the best, not only because Alexa sat still and read a book for a really, really long time for the rest of the day, but also because it allowed me to finally, super smooth-wise, offer her my favorite book growing up, which, and you all can go ahead and ready your mocking noises, is the Dolores Book of Greek Myths, which is the best illustrated children's Greek myths out there. So I recommend DC Superhero Girls and Dolores Book of Greek Myths, both of which my daughter consumed this weekend.
And I will just add that my 3.5-year-old has just discovered the exact same thing, DC Superhero Girls, and she's over the moon.
Yeah.
That's all she cares
it's
about
It's a good
anymore.
Series, man. I'm
this
not
is
gonna
how
lie.
They hook you.
Yep.
That's how it happens. That's all the hooking that we have time for here on the From the Reason podcast. Please subscribe to us on iTunes and write a review, rate us, and that kind of stuff. And stay tuned all week as we come out with more good podcast stuff. Thank you all, and good night.